Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show!
I'm Justin Savakis. Zach is out this week. Joining us in the guest chair is a guy that we've been trying to get on the show for a really long time. He is the former producer slash co-founder slash jack of all trades of the anime publisher Animego, and is currently a content developer, software engineer, part-time artist, musician, and Iron Chef wannabe. It is Shin Kurokawa. I can't believe I got all
great.
That.
Great. Oh, my gosh. You know, like, I honestly believe that I should have added a little more in there. But, yeah, that's enough. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's great.
Great to have you.
Yeah.
So, we wanted to get you on the show just because, you know, you've been slowly making the tours and getting kind of back into – I've finally started seeing you at conventions again recently.
Let's correct that a little bit.
Okay.
So the last official anime convention that I was at was I believe sometime in like 2002 or 2003, something like that. I keep getting invitations from various cons and whatnot, I've politely refused, and instead, I would send like my actors or my other industry friends instead of me. I mean, you know, like I've always been a behind the scenes kind of guy, you know, producing shows and whatnot, and I never really enjoyed being under the spotlight and what have you. I'd rather shine the spotlight on other people, you know. That's always. What was my case, and so I did that, and then around 2008 or something like that, I happened to be in Baltimore on business, and it was exactly the weekend that Otakon was happening, and so I went to, you know, say hi to my old friends, and then they were like, you know, come on over, you know, come to our dinners, and you know, like let's hang out, and let's go to the dead dog parties and whatever, and of course I had a great time, and you know, and then they kept my name in back of their minds, and finally early this year the chairman of Otakon. They said, Terry Chu, he said, he's also a very good friend of mine. And, he said, you know, Shin, you know, we really want you to be at Otakon this year. And I said the same thing again. You know, I said, Terry, you know, I don't really like to go to conventions anymore, but. And then he said, I really want you there because first of all, it's our 20th anniversary and we want to get together like all the old school people and so on. And I said, okay. Well, here are my demands. You're going to have to get me some Baltimore crab cakes, all right?
And twist his arm.
Well, yeah, exactly, right? So I agreed to that, and you know, they flew me, and I had a great time. I saw you. I mean, I hadn't seen you in like, you know, forever, and it was so great to catch up with you as brief as it was.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. I was running all over the place, but we've been wanting to get you on the show for a long time just because you know you were easily the most visible person at Animego back in the day. And you were at every I saw you at so many conventions back then.
Yeah.
And, like, you would allude to having stories, and I would hear snippets of some of them, but, like, I kind of, it's like, you know, those whole early days are such great, right. You know, spoken history that, you know, we're slowly, you know, as we get further and further away from that time in anime fandom, it's great to just go back and revisit and try to remember what it was like, because it was just so freaking different back then.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're talking about, like, mid to late 90s and then early 2000s, right? I mean, that phase is just not comparable to what's going on these days. I did feel like, you know, I was the face for Animego, even though, you know, like, I never wanted to be like that. You know, Robert Woodhead, he's the CEO of the company at the time, and he did make a lot of appearances back then, but somehow, slowly, I took over that function as far as the conventions went. And then you also had, you know, people like Toshi Yoshida, you know, being the, you know, becoming the face of Viz, and you also had my friend Jerry Chu. Jerry Chu was doing stuff for Bandai. Became the face for Bandai.
Sure, that came way later.
Yeah, much later. And then we also had Keith, you know, Keith Burgess for manga. And
So anyway, I would like to, you know, because we have listeners, I tried to keep this a little less inside baseball. Let's why don't we start way at the beginning, before Animego. You know, obviously you grew up with anime, but could you just describe your relationship to it before you became a pro, and your relationship with organized fandom?
Okay. How much time do we have?
Let's keep the Cliff Notes version.
okay. Let's say. All right. So let's make a Cliff Note version of this. All right. All right. I feel like anybody who was born and raised in Japan, you know, grows up with these things, you know, manga and anime, and it's everywhere. And I'm not talking about just shows and famous characters and whatnot. You got like caricatures of politicians and celebrities and, you know, like whoever, like all over the place. I mean, you ride one of those, you know, subways, and then there are, you know, there are stickers of Hello Kitty, you know, saying, hey, don't stick out your hand, you know, or you'll get hurt, you know, crap like that. And so as far as I can remember, well, I can't actually, I don't remember my first manga or anime experience, really. You know, it was always there.
You must have been like three, you know. Is that?
Well, I was born and then
yes.
I was not born as a 3 year old. Seriously, I mean, it was all over the place, and then you know, you take those things for granted, and so, you know, whenever people ask me, you know, how did you get into anime, I'm like, well, how did you get into Heinz Ketchup? You know, it's like, do you remember when you first discovered ketchup? You know, most people don't. You know, so it's sort of like that, and it's kind of a concept that most people don't get, because like a lot of the anime fans that we met over the years, you know, they discovered anime at a pretty late age. Like when they were like 20, or like maybe they're in their teen years, and then it was sort of a revolutionary eureka experience for those guys. You know, they said, "Oh my gosh, anime! This is great! You know, like, how come I didn't know this? You know, I didn't know this thing existed. So, and I'm like, what the? You know, I grew up in this stuff.
So when did you come to the U.S.?
I came to the U.S. when I was 12 years old. My entire family moved here. My father is one of those master chefs. He's one of the best in that field, Japanese cuisine, traditional Japanese cuisine and fusion. Kaiseki ryori. Yes, very good. Good. And, you know, fusion cuisine, because he traveled to a lot of places and then he tried to integrate many styles of cuisine and culture into his creations. And so, he was, he met some investors back in Japan while we were still there. And they asked him to open the very first Japanese restaurant in Atlantic City, of all places. And at the time, there was only one casino hotel, and there wasn't any Japanese restaurants in that area. And so they said, well, it's going to be a unique experience. And my dad, he always wanted to, you know, travel to anywhere. So he said, okay, tomorrow we are going to America.
it was that last minute. It's just, we're going to America.
Yeah. So, you know, like me being a 12-year-old and, you know, like I only have, you know, friends in Japan and had no knowledge of English except for like, you know, some phrases from American songs and whatnot. You know, I used to listen to some disco music and then, you know, you know, that R&B group, Chic, the disco, like Freak Out. that was like my thing back then. And then, of course, I used to watch, like Jimi Hendrix, you know, stuff on TV, you know, burning his guitar and crap like that.
If we're to place this time wise, we're talking late 70s, early 80s.
Am I supposed to reveal my age?
If you were a professional working for Animago back in like the early 90s, I think it's too late.
Okay. Well, you're absolutely right. you're not going to edit this part out. So I guess, okay. So I guess I'm going to have to confess. So time wise, I was 12 in 19. Wait a second. We actually immigrated here on the Christmas of 1979. So yeah. So that was that, 1979. I was 12. Well, I'm sorry, I was 11 years old. I was born in 1968. And hey, guess what? 3 days ago, it was my birthday.
Happy
4/5, man. 4/5.
So the now Atlantic City, if I recall, around that era was a little sketch.
it was ghetto.
Okay. I won't dance around it. It was a little terrifying. Could you describe the experience of like what your first encounter and just like what that was like trying to fit in?
Okay. Well, first of all, you know, when I was still a kid, growing up in Tokyo, I saw many Americans come into my dad's restaurant, and many of them were you know, stationed there, soldiers and what have you, and then they were always like super tall. They were like 6'6", 6'7", you know, like huge. And then, but they were like incredibly nice, you know. They tried to speak to us in broken Japanese, and you know, try to become friends with us, and you know, so I wasn't afraid of foreigners per se, but every time I watched like some you know, international celebrity interviews on Japanese TV. The subtitles that they used made them sound like they were like egotistical and then, you know, using all these languages that were kind of condescending. So I had a mixed emotions about, you know, going to America and, man. So when we moved to America, Atlantic City, of all places that we could have gone, Atlantic City, New Jersey. It's like, you know, like, and all the pictures that I've seen of America when I was a kid, you know, places like New York and LA and Chicago and, you know, places in the South with all these fabulous buildings, beautiful architectures and, you know, oceans, seas, rivers. And here we are in Atlantic City, and it's a freaking ghetto. And the only part that was nice was, well, I shouldn't say too many bad things about AC.
This is not current AC. This is 1980 AC.
This is 1980 AC. Boardwalk was fun. Boardwalk was fun, and then beach at the time was fairly clean, and like I said, there was only one casino hotel at the time, Resorts International, so surrounding that neighborhood was kind of pretty. Actually, it was sort of like a super condensed Las Vegas in a way, but once you stepped out outside that neighborhood, then you see all these crack houses and then dilapidated buildings, horrible like fields just not taken care of, and so that was a strange environment, and of course, you know, like over the years, little by little the city grew, and I have no idea how many casino hotels exist there, 30, 40, something like that. So when my family had that restaurant there, you know, a lot of celebrities travel. You had people like Tom Jones and Sheena Easton, Air Supply. I don't even know if people remember Air Supply.
I remember Air Supply, and that's all that counts.
Okay, good. So I got to meet them. I got to meet them all.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So how did you, so obviously, you know, a little fish out of water, a huge communication gap. I imagine those first few years were pretty scary and lonely, but how eventually you found the nerds.
Eventually I found the nerds. Nerds meaning otaku nerds and anime nerds.
What other meaning could I possibly be going for?
Well, before that, there's a little short phase that kind of affected me on a very personal level, and that was hate to say this, but I got bullied a little bit because I was in a community that was I would say 99% white, 1% minority, and then my family was probably the first Asian family that lived in that area. Now we didn't live in Atlantic City proper. We lived in the next city over, which was called Ventnor, you know, it's a very pretty little town without all the, you know, like ghetto-ness of Atlantic City. You know, there were some kids, you know, that always picked on me because, you know, I didn't look like them. But you know, the majority of kids, though, I mean, they accepted me and for what I was. And, you know, some of them are, you know, still you know, great friends to this day. And then, yeah, so I showed them, you know, like some of my stuff that I brought over from Japan, you know, like some comic stuff, you know, anime stuff and manga, what have you. And they're like, holy cow, like, what the heck is this? they liked it. And then a few years fast forward, and I got to college. I went to University of Chicago, and now when you go to, well, one of the first things that they made me do there was to take some language requirement test. And I studied French and Japanese. Well, I studied French in high school, and I've always spoken Japanese. So I took those two exams. Now my French exam was like so tough that by the time part two started, there was a native speaker that was asking questions in native French, and I could barely understand her, so I left. so automatically F, you know, it's like but Japanese exam, on the other hand, it was just too easy for me. I mean, it was like, you know, it's like I felt like a 5-year-old kid, you know. It's like, well, why am I supposed to be answering these questions? I mean, this is like, you know, what the hell is this? And so in the back of the exam, which was like a 2-hour exam, I said, you know, like, hey, you know, like, this is a pretty fun exam, but you know, you know, this is pretty stupid. You know, like, I wrote something that was like a very, very wise ass. Uh-huh. and I figured, you know, like after I left the exam room, I kind of regretted it, and I said, what did I just do? I bet I'm going to be disciplined or something, and I might get kicked out of school or whatever. But no, instead, the chairman calls me and says, hey, you know, like we need some teaching assistants, and we need speaking partners for my Japanese class students, and we also have a this thing called the Japanese Cultural Society, which meets once a week, and then we discuss about, you know, a bunch of random stuff, and then watch some Japanese movies and blah blah blah. And then so we need you to join us. And so, like an idiot, I said, okay, I'll do that. And so I did that. And then now this cultural society, this Japanese cultural society, aside from showing, you know, those old samurai movies and whatnot, they had a lot of anime shows. You know, like 10th generation Betamax copies, where it was like all sorts of, like, you know, glitches and whatnot, you know, showing on this 36 inch TV. So it was fuzzy as hell or whatever. And it wasn't subtitled or dubbed or whatever. So we had two or three people reading out, you know, the English scripts. You know, a real time translation kind of deal. Basically, it was like a purely human analog surround sound in its worst form. You know, it was pretty bizarre. And so from there, yeah, I noticed that, you know, like a lot more people started coming to those events whenever we had anime showings. And then around that time, Usenet, the news groups on the internet, you know, was getting pretty popular among college students. Now, this was around the time when internet was only available to universities and big corporations and then computer software developers and whatnot. I connected with many people around the world on this particular news group called rec.arts.anime. And I remember Ryan Gavigan was one of the first guys there, and Tatsugawa was there. Mike Tatsugawa, all good friends of mine.
Yeah, Mike Tatsugawa, of course, later went on to run the show at Anime Expo for many years.
And sure.
Now chairs Pacific Media Expo.
Definitely. Yeah, I have so much respect for those guys, and so that was what 20 years ago.
Yeah. All right, we got to go a little faster here because we're
okay.
out of time.
All right, so
let's. How did you become involved with what became Animega?
So I met Robert Woodhead on one of those Usenet groups, and he emailed me, and then we had some discussions. He told me that he had this business idea of getting proper licenses for anime titles, and then, you know, stick subtitles or English voices, and so that we could, you know, commercially and legally distribute them and make some money. And I said, you know, like, well good luck. You know, I didn't take that seriously. And I mean, you know, like, there was no definite business plans or whatsoever. And I don't think he was serious about it either, to be honest with you. You know, he was already well off from his other business interests, and you know, I was just this broke college student. But I had a lot of time to kill, like in between my research projects. I was doing a lot of computational research, and you know, back then computers were so slow, so each project would take, you know, like days to perform, and so in between, you know, you had, you know, a lot of coffee breaks. So I said, you know, hey, okay, well, why not, you know, like let's do this. And then you know, in exchange, you know, we agreed on the shares of the company and what have you, so we did that. Of course, we didn't make any money the first year or two. I think I made like $300 in residuals, royalties, and
you paid in royalties.
Well, shares, right. Okay. We did, you know, profit sharing and whatnot, and
so you weren't like paid hourly or anything.
Oh no! That was one of the first and definite agreements that we made, and it worked for gosh, almost 15 years until I left there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, what was the first title you guys released? Was Madox 1, right?
Yes, Madox 01.
Mm-hmm. And could you just describe a little bit of, like, what that was like to work on that first release, and what you learned possibly the hard way?
Okay, so the truth is that we didn't know what the hell we were doing, okay?
This is usually the case.
Yeah, exactly. So we just had to learn everything from scratch, and you had the script, you had this master tape, and you know, we had this one of the very first digital boards that would stick inside an Apple computer, which at the time I believe was a Macintosh 2. You know. Remember when Macs first came out? They looked like a little lunchbox, but Mac 2 became this rectangular thing.
Yeah, the thing was giant. It was like
it was
basically the size of a tower, current PC tower, laying flat.
Yeah, exactly. And it had slots for, you know, additional cards and stuff. So at that time, a company developed this digital video board that would allow you to embed subtitles and online graphics and whatnot for incoming video. And using that, Robert, you know, wrote a software to stick subtitles on, and it took a lot of experiments to do that right. I believe we worked on that title for like close to 9 months, maybe a year. We did, yeah. I mean, it was nothing but experiments, you know, for the longest time. But every time I got a new copy of work on progress, I was like, holy cow, you know, like, wow, we can do this kind of thing. Damn, this is fun. And you know, and finally, when we actually got the pre-master approval tape with a temporary label and packaging, I said, "Wow, this is great! I mean, oh my gosh! I mean, this is going to be on the shelf. The label that was on that VHS cassette tape, I mean, you know, was right, was perfect, and it had like copyright date and whatever, and then my name was even credited on the back of the packaging. The packaging cover art, it kind of sucked, you know, but then it didn't matter, you know. I felt like I actually accomplished something, you know. So yeah, that was an exciting time for me. I had three copies sent to me, and I sent one to my parents and said, "Hey, look what I did, you know, like I you know, I kind of stopped my physics research for a couple of months, but I did this cartoon stuff, and then now it's selling." And so their reactions were kind of mixed, to say the least.
So you get it out on store shelves. How did it do?
At first, it was miserable. Mm. One by one, it got picked up slowly over time. But you have to understand. I mean, we didn't have the support of, you know, Best Buy or Target or you know, like any of those big retailers. We had to sell like manually by going to science fiction conventions, and then we would you know, talk to you guys on Usenet and say, "Hey, you guys got Anime Club? Want to get our tapes at a discount?" You know, that sort of thing. And in the first year or two, it was all, you know, like word of mouth kind of thing. Yeah.
So what came next?
My gosh.
Okay, maybe not chronologically next. What was the next big one you remember?
The next big one, well, Bubblegum Crisis.
Right.
That just changed the whole thing for me personally, and then for the company. And I guess to a degree, it kind of changed the what the anime industry was and was going to be, because you have to understand, I mean, we were selling, you know, tens and hundreds of you know, copies of Madox 01 and Writing Bean and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, you know, we are selling tens of thousands of Bubblegum Crisis, you know, tapes, and of course the, you know, checks got bigger, which was nice. And yeah, and then also going to, you know, some of these earlier conventions, you know, I started seeing different types of people, not just, you know, sci-fi fans, but you know, people of all ages. And so a couple of years down the road, you had, you know, stuff like Sailor Moon, which I didn't work on, but, you know, it was on TV and whatnot. And then I think it was because of shows like that, that we, meaning all the anime industry people, was able to connect to people of even, you know, like, well, all ages, really. I see little kids. I mean, four or 5 year olds, and you know, people in their 80s and 90s and whatever. You know, and I saw all of them at Otakon the other day, and it was kind of emotional in a sense. Yeah, I'm kind of proud of what I did earlier. I'm proud of everybody that worked with me and people who are still working in that field. So it's great.
What were aside from Bubblegum Crisis, we'll come back to that. But what were some of the bigger hits, and what do you remember just bombing?
extremes, right? two extremes. Well, let's see. We had a great success with Oh My Goddess. Let's see. Vampire Princess Miu did pretty well for us. That was an four OVA series. And believe it or not, we had this project called Kimmel Gray Orange Road, KOR, and then we released that on VHS. This was back in early 90s, maybe mid 90s. And then sometimes
specifically not the TV series, but just the OVAs and the movie.
OVAs, movies, right. And then sometime later, you know, we realized that the popularity of KOR wasn't something to laugh about, and so we did, you know, a precursor to crowdsourcing or like Kickstarter. You know, we did an online poll and said, hey, do you guys want the TV series on Laserdisc, and if so, you know, how much are you guys willing to pay? And so we took all those numbers down, and we did some internal calculations, and then figured out we needed X number of orders, and then believe it or not, we got those X number of orders. So we took the time to, you know, produce that show. So that did well. Gosh, as far as the other extremes go, bombs. Oh my gosh, we had quite a few.
I remember the biggest one that was talked about at the time was Shonen Bak Sozoku, Bomber Bikers of Shonan.
Yeah, that. I don't even know if I put that thing on my resume, dude. To be honest with you. You know, another thing was the very first dubbed version of Rusei Yatsura.
Oh God.
which you know, I should never say these bad things because, you know, my dear friend, actually our dear friend, Michael Sinter Nicholas, that was one of his first jobs.
Well, yeah, he's not going to own up to it.
but let's say that it was a very good learning experience for everybody.
Sure. Okay. So, what was your jurisdiction there? I mean, there were obviously a few employees. What was your job?
For what? For those two titles?
Well, I mean, obviously your role drifted over the years. What was your specialty?
Well, let's see. Well, first of all, translating the scripts. Now, when I say translating the scripts, you know, you also had to do a lot of research. You had to get, you know, all of the supporting materials, you know, and let's say if it was like Rumiko Takahashi or some other famous writers, you had to get, you know, their other materials, and any sort of like cultural references, you had to, you know, like go really deep into it. This was before the days of Google, so you know, you couldn't just you know like search for stuff online. So I spent I spent a ton of research time at libraries and whatnot, and yeah, so times have changed, and then on top of that, of course you had to rewrite the translations, because obviously, you know, literal translations don't make much sense. You had to kind of find the equivalent of certain cultural references or the way certain things are said, and stuff like that. And aside from the translations, you know, we also had to do subtitling program, tons of stuff, and then a lot of studio work, you know, mastering and whatnot. And I think that's around the time when I picked up my digital video knowledge. So this was, you know, in the 90s, mid 90s. And then DVDs came, and then, oh my gosh, we could talk about that sometime later. That's another crazy phase.
Yeah. I was kind of there for that one.
Yeah.
one giant feather in Animego's cap is, I believe you guys completed over the course of many years, the longest anime release in North American history to this day, which is Urusei Yatsura.
Oh, yes.
Was it a hit, or was it more of a labor of love? Because I never could really tell.
Well, if it was a labor of love, I fell out of love sometimes. I think I left sometime during that production, but I do remember doing like hundred some odd episodes of it. You know, it's a beautiful piece of work, actually. You know, it's kind of outdated. The animation techniques are kind of rough, but you know, like when you pay attention to the combination of talents, oh my gosh! I mean, have you ever like paid attention to that soundtrack, that cheesy synthesizer sequenced soundtrack? And it, you know, it's done like a musical, and you know, it's a beautiful, I can't stress enough how incredible that was.
But you learned, and to then hate it.
Yeah. well, I never hated that. But I just kind of fell out of love with the fact that, you know, oh gosh, it's time to make donuts again, and you know, here's another episode of Urusei Yatsura, and so
but did it do fairly well?
I wasn't there when they actually completed it. By that time, I was already out of Animego's picture, and I was doing work in Japan and Asia. So, but from what I can understand, you know, it was, I mean, they had a huge core fan base for Urusei Yatsura. So, you know, I really hope that they did well. I mean, the licensing cost alone was like enormous. So I hope they recovered all that money. Yeah.
I just wanted to touch on this. Now, I remember the first few Animego dubs,
sure,
being a little bit rough.
Understatement there.
Not just those obnoxious aliens, the notorious Urusei Yatsura dub that only got two episodes.
Right.
But also, let's face it, that Bubblegum Crisis dub, a little shaky.
Understatement.
What... were some of the weirdness and frustrations and like learning curves in doing that? Because if I'm remembering correctly, Bubblegum Crisis didn't even have separate music and effects tracks.
Right. Well, first of all, that was something that was dictated to us by the music publisher. I believe at the time it was Toshiba EMI over in Japan, and so we only had few elements to work with, and remember this was, you know, like really early on in this whole anime U.S. anime industry phase. So as far as dubbing was concerned, you know, we were just only starting to learn how to do it properly. And yeah, I mean, those first releases, by today's standards, I would hate to say this, but, you know, they were subpar. Yeah, I admit. Yeah, we learned a lot.
Were you trying to do those in-house, or how did that work?
In the case of Bubblegum Crisis, we had a local studio that specialized in music and in occasional ADR work for commercial spots and whatnot. Great musicians too, and so we had their help, and you know, they worked like pretty much 24/7. Actually, my Sinter Nicholas was one of the sound engineers, if I recall, towards the later episodes. And maybe he had a part in a Bubblegum Crash episode or something like that. You should ask him. And then later on, we got another studio called Coastal Carolina Studios, run by a guy named Scott Hull, a great, great, incredibly talented guy. I mean, he's used to doing ADRs for Hollywood movies and locally shot TV shows, which at the time were stuff like Dawson's Creek and you know, like whatever. So he had the connections. He knew how to work with the actors, you know, and it was great. I mean, he worked on several titles for us. Oh My Goddess, some of the Rupan movies, and I had a great time working with him. But in his case, you know, he doesn't like people looking over his shoulders. He's one of those producers, you know, like same with me. I hate it. I absolutely hate it when somebody's like looking at like what I'm doing from behind my back. I just want to be alone. Right.
Shut up. Let me do my job.
Exactly. So we never, you know, interacted while the studio sessions were going on. So every so often he would say, okay, well, I got a few minutes to, you know, do nothing, you know, want to come over, you know, and I would bring a six pack, you know, middle of the night, and we would like, you know, go over, you know, like what we did that day and blah, 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 corrected a few things, you know, great relationship we had. Yeah.
Cool. Any titles that you're like, oh, I wish I, you know, in retrospect, I wish I could have done that differently, or, you know, I wish we had treated that show differently.
I don't have any regrets. I hate to have regrets. There were many, many times that I felt that way early on in my career. I do remember going to this one convention out in Chicago sometime during the mid 90s, and then a bunch of fans came up to me and said, you know, like, why did you have to translate, you know, such and such this way on a particular show? And then, you know, at the time, I didn't know better. And so I took it very personally. You know, I didn't fight back or anything like that, but it just made me kind of feel weird. And, that was on my mind for like many, many weeks to come. And I was like, you know, I felt like a totally depressed maniac, you know, and then you know, eventually I learned to let, you know, stuff like that go. And so these days, you know, like I don't look back. Once something is done, you know, let it go. You know, you had a great time doing it. If there were any, you know, negative memories, you know, just let them go and do other things.
Is there anything you think Animego could have done better in retrospect?
Well, I guess it sort of ties to, you know, the previous question. We did some, you know, I won't lie to you. We did some rewritings of certain lines, with certain references to certain sci-fi shows and whatnot. If you Google those things up, I'm sure you'll find hundreds of, you know, such postings and whatnot. But I wasn't exactly a fan of that. But you know, like ultimately, you know, it was an executive decision. You know, Robert had to, you know, change those at the last minute, just as I was mastering at the studio. I didn't like that, but hey, you know, like I don't think we lost, you know, thousands of fans that way.
Yeah. Were there any like incidents interacting with fans that stick out in your memory, aside from that one where they were griping about your translation choices?
I think I became what's known as a con whore. like around, gosh, I would say like late 90s and then early 2000s.
You were kind of everywhere for a while.
Yeah, because I had to do a lot of promoting work for Macross, which someone could, you know, like write a book about, you know, like what went on in that production. But anyway, so I had a lot of promotion work for that title, and then of course, you know, promoting other titles and whatnot. And so, you know, like every con invited me, and you know, I said yes to most of them. And around that time, the demographics of the fan base kind of changed, and all of a sudden you started seeing you know, a lot of girls wearing you know, very very Victoria's Secret kind of things, and then so, you know, I felt like some rock celebrity or maybe, you know, some kind of roadie for Def Leppard or something. You know, I always got surrounded by those girls, and then they were like, oh my gosh, and, you know, I want to hang out with you, you know, first time you experience it as a single guy, you know, you take advantage of that, right? And so I had a great time then, but eventually I noticed that like none of them had ever seen any of my show. So I felt like, like, yeah. So that was another reason why, you know, I kind of said no to conventions after that. Besides, you know, conventions were getting so much bigger and bigger and much higher in frequency. And, I mean, this year, how many cons were there? Like 200 or something?
Yeah, but it's, we can't keep track anymore.
Yeah.
I only go to a handful now. I'm just like, and
yeah,
I'm exhausted by the end of con season.
Yeah, I mean, back then, meaning to those late 90s, my con-whore years, there may have been, like, what, 20, 30 cons at most. And then the biggest one that I went to was, like, maybe, gosh, I forgot which one, but maybe 3,000, 4,000 people were there. Not counting something like Anime Expo, which always had, you know, like a lot of fans, as well as industry people and all of their connections.
Yeah, AX Node had kind of been the biggest for many, many years.
Yeah.
All right, so when did you start thinking, I'm kind of getting sick of this. Maybe it's time to start thinking about moving on.
I kind of felt that way for many, many years. Because I was there in the very beginning when we only had like hundreds of fan base, you know, hundreds of people. And then we started getting thousands of fans and whatnot. Sailor Moon, was on TV. Pokemon was on TV. All of a sudden, you know, like every kid going to, you know, grade school, high school, they know about anime. And by that time, you know, all these major outlets like Target and whatever, you know, they had anime section, you know, with hundreds of anime titles on their shelves, and you know, going to conventions around that time, people recognized me just looking at my name and said, they were like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, you worked on such and such, you know, it's so great to meet you. Some of them sent me fan mails. I remember getting tons of presents at my office. Even had several people just coming to my office because our office address was published and whatnot.
Oh, that's weird.
Oh gosh, very weird. I had one guy actually knocking on my door in my condo.
What?
Yeah. that was probably the most bizarre experience. You know, he just wanted to meet me, and it's like I kind of politely refused it. Great, you know, thanks for coming, but this is my place and my private time. You know, I think I gave him like a bunch of stickers, stickers.
Go away.
Yeah, just go away. You know, get lost. You know, never come here, please.
God.
And so, yeah, and also, you know, like by that time, there were so many competitors. Well, I don't even know if I should refer to them as competitors, because, you know, like we were all selling different products, but we were the anime industry, and you know, I saw how they did their business, and there was a lot of greed and a lot of you know, stepping over somebody's toes kind of deal, and you know, frankly, I didn't exactly, you know, feel comfortable, you know, being in that kind of environment. And you know, because like I never did this for you know, fortune or fame, and so I felt kind of weird. And so, you know, I had this plan of leaving the American side of things, you know, completely, and I wanted to migrate over to the Japanese side of anime production, meaning creation and developing and implementing all the workflows and whatnot in Asia. So those plans were getting solidified during like 2000, 2001 while I was working on Macross. 9/11 happened, and then we lost several thousand pre-orders for that Macross DVD set. And
that's such a strange connection. Why do you think that happened?
Well, nobody wanted to spend any money anymore.
Oh.
You know, because of the uncertainties with such a, you know, horrible tragedy. And so, you know, sales were down, and we had, gosh, five-digit, you know, number of pre-orders, you know, committed, and then, you know, we lost thousands of them, like overnight or like days to come. And I'm saying, holy shit, you know. Can we say that S word here?
Oh yeah, you can. We drop F bombs constantly. Don't worry.
Okay. Because like I seem to recall listening to one of your older podcasts, and then somebody said "weather pussy," and that was like perfectly allowed.
That was so, me. And
oh,
yes.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. What was I saying?
9/11 pre-order drop.
So now that Macross project was a super expensive project, you know, studio bills were piling up, and then originally I was able to convince everyone that yeah, you know, like we could do it and then make, you know, make a sizable profit, you know, even after spending, you know, this much money on the production work. I was able to do that prior to 9/11, and then right after that event, that all changed, and I lost confidence. I lost people, the upper management, you know, couldn't exactly have much trust in me, and again, I took things kind of too personal, not on the, you know, like purely business level, and so, you know, adding up all those factors, you know, I just wanted to kind of take a break or just get out of the American side of things altogether. An opportunity came to me. There was an offer for a buyout. Actually, that happened several times over the years, but this one, you know, like right at the end of 2001, you know, and I took it, you know. It was not the amount that I expected, but I took it anyway because I just wanted to do my thing. And so that happened, and then 2002 came. I think we were still trying to finish You Are Under Arrest, and I believe that was like a 48 episode series, right? And I think I as soon as episode 30 or something was done, it was time for me to go. I wanted to do something totally different, travel for a while, you know, some kind of a zen phase, needed to meditate a little bit. I took it easy, you know, I took it easy for a little bit. And then next thing you know, I get a call from Sony in Japan and said, "Hey, we like what you did with Macross, and we're working on this long series called Legend of Galactic Heroes, and we need some restoration work done." And I said, "Wait a second, isn't that like a 300 episode show?" And so, and
wow.
They said, yes, it is. and I said, I am sorry, but I am not doing a 300 episodes show, you know. Even if I could get like all my, you know, all my peeps that I worked with during the Macross era, you know, there was no way that I wanted to do it because I first of all, I mean, it's a talking heads kind of animation, and it's very story driven, and you know, I just didn't feel like up to it, you know. Even if they paid me, you know, like millions of dollars to do it, you know, like I don't think I would have done it. And so I told them, you know, like, hey, if you're really really serious about doing this, you know, like, why don't we get, you know, several teams together, several studios together, and I'll be one of them, and we'll split up the workload. That way, we can finish everything in a reasonable amount of time. And so they got back to me like a couple of days after that, and they said, okay, so we got seven teams in Japan now, you're the eighth, and so we're gonna send you every few episodes master tapes, and then you get back to us the restored footage. Does that sound cool to you? And I said, okay, well, that's doable. And they gave me, there was a poor intern working for them, for Sony, who actually had to log everything, every type of flaw, like by drawing on a piece of paper. And then they sent me this telephone book sized envelope, you know, for the episodes that I was supposed to work on. You know, like frame such and such has a little scratch at the bottom.
Oh my god! Like one piece of paper. Here's what yeah, the mistake looks like.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, poor intern. Holy shit! How much was he paid for this? And I called him up and said, you know, this is not necessary. You know, like my software, you know, it does this like semi automatically. You know, most of the scratches, you know, it can be just done, you know, without specifying anything. And they didn't believe me at first, but I sent them a remastered tape, and they were like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. And so I worked on several episodes that way. And then a strange thing happened much later on. Because the episodes were sent to us in random order, when the producer looked at them one by one, every episode, every certain episode looked kind of strange, depending, compared to other episodes. Every certain episode looked way too clean and didn't fit the rest of the series. And guess what? I mean, those were the episodes that I worked on. And so he said, hey, Shen, you know, like about your remastered tapes, we got a situation here. They look too good. and so I said, well, what does that mean? You know, you guys never, you know, given me any specific parameters except for this and that. And so they sent me some of the remastered tapes from their end, and had to copy the looks and what have you. And so we completed that. I think they sold that entire 300 episode plus movie DVD set for like $10,000 or something. It's just something like absolutely ridiculous. But you know, like any show, there's always, you know, some core fan base that are willing to pay that price. So I'm glad that went well for them. And uh, so So, and one thing leads to another, and, you know, stuff like that took me to other places, and, you know, I got to meet, you know, other studios and creators, eventually doing some development work for new shows and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
I see. So, and that's really cool. And what can you just describe a little bit about the sort of work you're doing now?
Yeah. So I did some of that content developing for a while. You have to understand that, you know, like for every project that gets greenlit and fully developed, there must be like hundreds of others that never get completed, never get done. And I had a lot more failures than successes. And I was always into technology, you know, and I was always a good, you know, software programmer. I used a lot of, you know, computer graphics and then digital special effects for whatever. And little by little, you know, I got into that software engineering business, specifically targeted to the Hollywood market. There were several individuals who were very already accomplished in that field, and then they took me under their wings. Some of them won Academy Awards for their work and stuff, and then I was very fortunate to have worked with those people. And so I created a bunch of software, you know, for movies and music videos, TV, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, you know, you get to kind of re-exercise your part of the brain that was kind of soaked with all sorts of mathematical and physical knowledge, and, you know, and you know, seeing stuff come alive on the computer screen is like, you know, it's pretty fun.
So now that, you know, now that you have some distance of years between your current self and the self that worked in the anime industry, as it were, mm-hmm. What are your thoughts when you look back? Is it a time you remember fondly, or is you just go, oh God, I can't believe I put up with that for so long?
Well, there's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, I'm not completely isolated from the anime industry. On a semi-regular basis, I deal with anime studios that are using my stuff, my software, and I tend to kind of give them a, you know, little extra help, because the animators are not technicians, they're not programmers, and so you know, I want to make sure that you know, they exercise their expertise, which is in animating and in-betweening, painting and whatnot. And then as a post-production process, they get to use my software. So, oh my goodness. I talk to them a lot. Yeah, as far as my opinions are concerned about the anime industry, again, I mean, how much time do we have? You know, there are things that make me absolutely proud of the fact that, you know, that there are all these fans that are supporting the industry, and you know, in whatever capacity. One sad thing about that is that the purchasing power and the way that distribution is done these days, technologically, you know, there's a lot of lost revenues because of piracy or what have you, and so the you know, from a producer's point of view, and creator's point of view, you kind of have to, you know, think about that, you know. When you're developing a show, say, okay, so we want to, you know, create this fabulous, you know, like show for $3 million, which isn't that much when you're talking about, you know, like very nice quality-driven, story-driven anime feature. How much can we get in return in 2003? You know, if you had asked that question 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the answers would have been extremely, extremely different. I would be so scared to give a baseballpark, ballpark figure, as to like how much we can get in return. I mean, it's great that anime is really popular. You know, kids love it, adults love it. You know, everybody likes it. But how much money are we, the creators, are getting? I mean, animators themselves are, you know, getting paid a minimum wage, and a lot of them are in other parts of Asia where the cost of living is much lower. Therefore, you know, they get, you know, paid even less. So, you know, that kind of inequality, you know, I'm not too pleased about. There has to be a, you know, kind of a solution. Yeah. So, sorry, I'm getting kind of like too emo about stuff like that.
Hey, I mean, that's, you know, we love that you care.
Right. Yes, I do care.
Well, we don't want to take up too much more of your time here, but we just have a handful of questions from our listeners on Twitter.
Oh, they're actually listening to this on Twitter?
Well, they're not listening through Twitter, but we asked for questions for you, and they responded on Twitter.
Oh, in advance. Okay.
Yes, in advance.
Okay.
So most of these we actually covered, but here's a good one. Land of Obscusion asks, since Robert Woodhead will never state why, hopefully you can answer it, why didn't Animego ever license the Wizardry OVA?
Oh, gosh. I do remember talking about that maybe 20 years ago. But I don't remember the answer.
It wasn't very good.
Well, we all know that. I guess from the... I'm pretty sure, you know, like he can tell you like every detail about that. But from the business perspective, I don't believe that it would have generated enough sales to justify licensing it.
And by that time, no one even remembered Wizardry. Wizardry, for our younger fans, was literally the first PC RPG.
Right. And it's kind of funny. When I first met Robert, which was like 3 years after we met online, you know, he told me about his past, that he made, you know, like gazillions of money, you know, making Wizardry and then Virex and, you know, stuff like that. And I'm like,
Virex being an early antivirus program.
Right. For Mac. And, I knew about Virex and, but Wizardry, I don't know, I've never heard of it. And so I figured it was like one of those, you know, like obsolete Dungeons and Dragons kind of like card game or whatever. So I never cared about that. And it wasn't until like years later that, you know, like I was reading some magazine or whatever, talked about old school Apple video games and how Wizardry was like one of the, you know, like most popular ones. It's like, oh, so that's what he worked on. I see.
I remember my dad got a copy for his old IBM PC. Uh-huh. You know, the kind that used to come without a hard drive and you had to add a card to get display monochrome graphics.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, I was kind of shocked, because even back then I was like, why doesn't this have any character artwork? It's just, like, a picture of a dungeon.
Yeah. You know, talking about, like, all these old computers, I think we are losing 50% of our audience.
Oh, they're right all now. Gone anyway. No, they love hearing us talk about the olden days.
So for the 20 of you that are still listening to this, okay, next Twitter question.
Okay. Why did Central Park Media get Urusei Yatsura Movie 2 Beautiful Dreamer instead of you guys? Yeah, you wouldn't know the next one. But that was from Doto 004.
Yeah, the beautiful... Robert and J.O.D., I should say John.
John O'Donnell.
John O'Donnell. At the time. Yeah. I always call him J.O.D.
We did too.
His initials, you know, John. Great guy.
Okay.
Whom I haven't seen in a while, but anyway, so those two guys were in Japan at the same time trying to license Urusei Yatsura, and John picked Beautiful Dreamer first as sort of like an experiment, and then Robert went to the same guys and said that, hey, you know, like I want to license like all of these movies and OVAs and whatever. And the licensor said, well, there's just one problem. You know, your competitor just picked up a license for one movie. And so here we are, you know, Animego has the complete, you know, catalog of Urusei Yatsura except for one movie. And I guess we thought about, you know, like how to package everything together, you know, like should we leave a slot for CPM's Beautiful Dreamer such that all the cover work match or whatever. And then after, you know, like some chit chats, Animego ended up engineering that tape. You know, we translated, subtitled, and all that stuff. So that was like one of the coolest times in which two totally different anime distribution companies worked together.
Something that would never happen again.
Exactly. Yeah, so that was beautiful.
Yeah, that's wow. Well, back then there was a much more cooperative air between the studios, I think.
I think so too. The fact that it wasn't a saturated industry, and then there were, you know, only several entities like us existed. So
it wasn't yet super competitive.
Exactly, and then we knew everyone, you know, we knew each other. We were all on a first name basis. I mean, you know, so yeah, these days it's, you know, some companies are run by lawyers, and, you know, it's just different, you know. I can't say any bad things about them, but it is what it is, and you know.
Yep. All right. Lastly, I just want to end this on a funny note. This is from Land of Obscusion. Also, just how big of a bomb was Bomber Bikers of Shonan?
Oh my god!
Well, actually, that is an interesting question, because like back in the day, how many sales are we talking about to really call something a bomb?
Something a bomb, something that would sell less than 1,000 or 2,000 copies, and if if that was like three digits, then it's like bomb of a bomb. I'm pretty sure that over the years, I'm just guesstimating that it might have sold 1,000 or so, 1,000 or 2,000. I don't know, But at the time when I was working on it, yeah, we would be lucky to send one copy out to a customer somewhere in Canada, like every few months.
Why the Canadians?
They're far more advanced culturally than us.
So our boss likes to remind us. So, all right then. Thank you so much for coming on. This was a whole lot of fun for me, and I hope for our listeners as well.
Oh yeah, ditto. I mean, I haven't seen you in several years since you left New York, and it was so good to see you again.
Likewise.
In Baltimore. You know, like we should, try to catch up again. You know, give me a call anytime, and if you're ever in the East Coast again, hit me up.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Shin for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a rating, a review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.